Reading is taken from Mark chapter 7, verses 14 to 23, which can be found on page 1016. Mark chapter 7, 14 to 23. And he called the people to him again and said to them, "Hear me, all of you, and understand. There is nothing outside a person that by going into him can defile him. But the things that come out of a person are what defile him." And when he had entered the house and left the people, his disciples asked him about the parable. And he said to them, "Then are you also without understanding? Do you not see that whatever goes into a person from outside cannot defile him, since it enters not his heart, but his stomach, and is expelled? Thus he declared all foods clean." And he said, "What comes out of a person is what defiles him. For from within, out of the heart of man, come evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, coveting, wickedness, deceit, sensuality, envy, slander, pride, foolishness. All these evil things come from within, and they defile a person."
Nadia, thank you very much indeed for reading. Do hold that passage open, please. The way Mark advertises those question times, it's enough to make anyone want to speak for 40 minutes, but I'll try not to do that this lunchtime to give lots of time for questions. I think our title today is an excellent question. Can we be good without God? You may have come across some of the atheistic literature that's been written recently addressing this question exactly. It's one of the buzz questions that's going around in atheistic, theistic dialogue at the moment. And it's a good title because it affirms the desire to be good. And in our society, that is an increasingly important starting point, isn't it? There was a headline in the Evening Standard in January that said 5 teenagers a day are either stabbed or shot, not fatally necessarily, but 5 a day either stabbed or shot, just here in London. Again, year ending March 2007, police in England and Wales recorded over 57,000 sexual offences. That's those that are reported and recorded formally, 57,000. It's no surprise then that we hear politicians talking about change and that it sounds attractive to us. And politicians of all stripes want to ask the question, how can we persuade people to be good? If we want a good society, more personally, if we want a good heart, do we need God or can we do it without him? And the short answer to that question from the perspective of Jesus Christ is no. No, we cannot be good without God. That's not to say that Christians believe that we are innately morally superior to non-Christians. We'll see that that's not the case. Or that we think that every unbeliever is some sort of freaky crime wave waiting to hit the streets of London. That's not the way that Christians feel about the universe at all. But it is to say, without God, we cannot be good. 2 points this lunchtime and then your questions for me. You'll see them on the sheet there. First, without God, we can't even define good. We can't even know what we're talking about. Very obviously, when you ask the question, can we be good without God, it begs the more basic question, how do we know what good is? How should we define good? And philosophers like Immanuel Kant and others have been trying to answer that question for hundreds of years. But the sticking point has always been, if we're trying to find a universal standard of absolute morality that will apply equally to all people in every situation, then who decides what that standard should be? Who has the right to draw up an ethical code that we can then impose upon everybody in every land? You may not believe in God, but you can probably see why, if there is a God, if there's a God who created the whole world and everything in it, if there's a God who in his very person is the definition of goodness and justice, then that being, that God, would have every right to draw up the list. But if, as increasingly we try to do in our society, we count God out of the equation, if there's no eternal being or reference point against whom we can measure ourselves, then the question comes, whose definition should we follow instead? Who has the right, the ability to make that choice? It'd be fine if we all agreed, but what happens when we don't? What about when there's a clash of opinions between you and your colleagues about who should get the coffees? Or more seriously, between George Bush and Osama bin Laden about whose vision for world reality should take precedence? Then whose opinion do we follow? In response to that question, people often say, leave it to the majority, let them decide, and we'll go with what they want. Morality, they say, is culturally relative, and in any given culture, the majority should be allowed to win. But you have to ask the question, is the majority always right? Have they always been right historically? In Nazi Germany, for example, when they voted in Hitler. Well, what happens if there's two tribes on an island and the majority white tribe decides that the minority black tribe should be killed? What do you do then? Is the majority always right? We're asking, can we be good without God? And the answer is no. Without God, we can't even know what good is. Even the concept of goodness is unattainable, let alone the lived out reality of it. In case you think I'm overstating this point, I'm going to quote from an unlikely ally for Christianity here in the person of Richard Dawkins. You'll know he's no friend of Christianity, but in The God Delusion, he has a chapter on morality in which he admits our first point here. He says this, "Not all absolutism is derived from religion." He talks about patriotism as well, but I think that that's a false argument. Not all absolutism is derived from religion. Nevertheless, it is pretty hard to defend absolutist morals on grounds other than religious ones. In other words, if there's no ultimate being, you can't talk about ultimate goodness. So I don't think I'm saying anything particularly new or controversial here. Lots of people scrub God out of their mind without realizing the full implications of what they're doing. And I'm saying if you want to get rid of God, you need to realize that part of the collateral damage that goes along with that exercise is that any meaningful definition of goodness goes out of the window and you lose any absolute right to talk about things like right and wrong. And you see the fallout of that in our society all around us. When ethical quandaries stump politicians and philosophers alike, and we see a generation growing up that places such a small value on human life. Of course, that doesn't prove Christianity in and of itself to be true. I'm not suggesting for a moment it does. It's not true just because the alternative is unpalatable. It's true because Jesus Christ is Lord and he rose from the dead in history. And again, you can ask about that if you want to. But I do want to argue that you can't have your cake and eat it, as it were. That you can't get rid of God and at the same time cling on to notions like right and wrong. Can we be good without God? No. We can't even define good if there's no ultimate being. Second answer. Without God, we can't be good either. And because of the way that the debate is going within the circles at the moment, I think it's helpful for us here to distinguish between what we might call motivations for doing good on the one hand and then moral attainment on the other. And you'll forgive me for using slightly longer words at that point. I say that because over the last few years, atheistic writers like Richard Dawkins have begun working hard to answer the challenge, if there is no God, why should I be good? What would motivate me to do good things? Illustrate. So let's say I'm walking down an alley at night time and I find a beggar lying there in the street. And it's someone who's abused me in the past, and I'm sure that no one can see me. If that's the situation, and if that beggar is just a sack of chemicals, like the scientific materialist or the naturalist would want to argue, and if no one's watching me, and if it's all about survival of the fittest, and if there's no God in the sky who's watching me either, then why shouldn't I just kick him or kill him if I know I'm not going to be caught? If there's no God, why be good? And in answer to that question, the God delusion, Dawkins follows the writings of people like Michael Shermer and Mark Hauser and says we don't need God to motivate us to be good. That's a specious argument. We don't need God to motivate us to be good because actually natural selection itself gives us enough reasons to be good. Classically, he argues that the simple desire to see my gene pool advance lets you know why I'm nice to my wife and why I don't eat my children for breakfast, even if there's no Weetabix in the house or something. I want my gene pool to survive. Of course I'm going to be nice to my kids and family. Again, he talks about reciprocal altruism, so that the theory goes, if my neighbors ask me for a cupful of sugar, then it's actually in my own interest to give one to him, because next week I might need some milk if I've run out, and I could do with him being kind in return. In other words, I don't help you because I like you. I help you because I'm selfish, and I'm worried that I might need your help one day. And so Dawkins concludes, of course we don't need God to motivate us to be good. Even within an atheistic view of the world, there are reasons to be good. I think some of what he says makes some sense. I think there's more to it. But that discussion about motivations, which is where it's gone in the literature, is something of a distraction, I think. Because our question today doesn't ask us, can we be motivated to be good without God? It asks us, can we actually be good without God? It's not about our motivations, it's about our moral attainment. And in our society, we don't need people to be better motivated. We need people to have better behavior. We need them to stop stabbing one another. And so for the rest of our time, I want to address that point head on by asking you a fairly simple question. And it's this: being honest for a minute, as you look at your own heart, are you good? Of course, we most often hear, bless you, of course, we most often hear people say that when crime happens, it's because of a failure to educate. Or if there's a downward trend in our society, too many teenage pregnancies, the problem is we haven't got enough sexual education. So you've got to start that at age 4 or something, just to make sure that we do it in time. Now, you guys are among some of the most educated people in the Western world. So lack of education isn't going to be the problem here. In your heart, are you good? I asked someone else that question once, and he stopped and thought about it for a moment, and then he smiled and said, that depends on whether you mean the mask that I wear, the public persona that I portray to other people in the office and around the place, or what's really going on the inside. That's what happens when you chat to people from ABN AMRO, as it was in the back in the day before they got taken over, I guess. So just to clarify, though, I'm not talking about public persona, the things that you say to your friend's face. I'm talking about in the secret places of your heart, the things you say behind their back. We're talking about the unspoken desires and impulses inside us, the hidden world of feelings. Are you good? Are you consistently good? Here in Mark, it's taken us a long time to get there, but Jesus says if you want to know what you're really like, the way you find out is by looking at what comes out of your heart, stands to reason. He says if you're basically good, then good stuff will come out of your heart. But if that's not what comes out, if your heart is like a fountain, not of kindness and purity and love, but instead of selfishness and greed, well, then that will tell us what you're really like. And then he goes on to give what you might call his courtroom verdict on our hearts. And it's there on the sheet, but it's also there in verse 20 in the book in front of you in Mark's Gospel on page 1016. He says, what comes out of a person is what defiles him or her. For from within, out of the heart of man, come evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, coveting, wickedness, deceit, sensuality, envy, slander, pride, foolishness. All these evil things come from within, and they defile a person. I won't run through the list in lots of detail, but Jesus' point is very obvious. He's saying, deep down on the inside, the produce of our heart is not good. And that's because you and I are basically not good people. Not as bad as we might be, but not as good as we should be. And we could put Jesus to the test on that. So if you look down at the list, evil thoughts is probably an umbrella term that's then defined by the other 12 terms that come after it. Some of them refer to specific acts of wrongdoing, others are attitudes of the heart. Sexual immorality is all forms of sexual activity and fantasy outside of heterosexual marriage. Murder includes on Jesus' definition, the angry rage that we feel inside when we don't get our own way. Coveting is wanting that which is not rightfully ours. Deceit is being willing to bend the truth sometimes to suit ourselves. Pride. Which of us has never looked down on someone else? Or tried to take some glory for ourselves that rightly belongs to God? But Jesus isn't just wanting us to analyze each of these 12 terms and then to give ourselves a score out of 12 and think, well, look, I think I'm doing all right on 4 of them, so I might be okay. He's building a cumulative case here. And his purpose is that none of us should sit here today protesting our innocence. He's saying your heart is not good because you are not a good person. There was a famous correspondence in the Times about 100 years ago trying to answer the question, what is the problem with the world? It's interesting, the question hasn't changed in 100 years. And a famous journalist, G.K. Chesterton, wrote a two-word answer, the substance of the letter, Dear Sir, I am. Yours, G.K. Chesterton. It's very astute, isn't it? C.S. Lewis wrote of his own experience of encountering Jesus Christ in the Gospels, and testing his own character and heart against the standards of Jesus, as they're revealed here in Mark 7, for example. And he wrote, for the first time, I examined myself with a seriously practical purpose. And there I found what appalled me. A zoo of lusts, a bedlam of ambitions, a nursery of fears, a harem of fondled hatreds. To speak very personally, I didn't grow up in a Christian home, but one of the things that I found most compelling about the teaching of Jesus Christ when I was first exposed to it was the way that he knew my heart. Do you find that? There was I being told and wanting to believe that I was basically a good person who may occasionally choose to do the wrong thing because it's convenient, but basically I was good. In my essence. And Jesus said, no, you're not. Your heart is like a fountain of evil. Are you one of those people like me? I don't like being told I'm wrong. So I tried putting Jesus to the test. And the way that a friend told me to do it was to try and go 24 hours without saying, thinking, or doing anything that was unkind, impure, or untrue. Sounds fairly easy when you're sitting here, doesn't it? I try, you give it a go over the next 24 hours. Don't write down everything. I didn't even make it to an hour. I want to be a good man. I want to be the best husband that there's ever been. I want to be the best father that there's ever been. I want people to think that those who work for me, that I'm a good boss, that I'm kind, that I'm generous. I want to be a good man. I really do, but I find that I keep mucking up. You like that? You keep getting it wrong. You say, I'm going to try harder from now on. I'm never going to do it again. And you keep doing it. You keep saying it. The thought comes back. Why is that? Is it because we're basically good people who can be good without God? Or is it, as Jesus says, because our hearts are flawed? I suppose there'll be some here who admit that of themselves, but at the same time refuse to allow themselves to be troubled by it. They'll say, okay, so I may not be good, but who cares? Surely it doesn't really matter. Everyone's the same. And the sting in the tail of our passage this lunchtime is that it really does matter because God cares. Can you glance down to verse 20 first, please, and see where Jesus says there, what comes out of a person is what defiles him. And then in verse 23, all these evil things come from within, and they defile a person. So you'll see that the word defile brackets this little section and is there to focus our mind on the abiding significance of the state of our heart. Defiled. The word's drawn from the Jewish sacrificial system, and it means to be unfit for the presence of God. So that when the Apostle John is talking about heaven in the book of Revelation, he says, nothing that is defiled will enter it. And he uses the same word that Jesus uses here. He's saying, if your heart is like mine, if it's defiled, then on the day when God decides who gets into heaven and who doesn't, you and I are in big trouble. I've told some of you before that not long before he died, Bobby Moore was asked what it was like to receive the World Cup from the Queen back in 1966. And he said he wasn't so much excited as he walked up the steps at the old Wembley as terrified. Because apparently as he walked up the steps, he looked down at his hands and he saw that they were caked in mud. And then he looked along to where the Queen was standing and saw that she was wearing pristine white gloves, as she so often does, that clearly were on their maiden voyage out of the palace. And so on the footage, you can see him doing this, scraping his hands furiously against his shorts, trying to get the mud off so that he didn't contaminate the Queen. But his shorts are filthy too. And so as he's walking up, it should be the greatest moment of his life, all he's thinking about is how filthy he is. Which gets you thinking about how you'll feel when you appear before the perfect God as your judge. A lady said to me recently, there'll be no place in heaven for me because there's too much wickedness in my heart. God is so pure, he cannot even look at evil. As we approach him, we will know that there's no way we deserve a place in his heaven. No way at all. And that leaves only one place for us to go with our evil hearts. And it is not good news. Which is why I'd be remiss if I wrapped up without telling you about the good news of Christianity. Indeed, I think the very heart of Christianity, which is that even though we are dirty, even though our hearts are evil, when Jesus Christ came, he came for people whose hearts were evil. Don't mishear me. It's not okay that our hearts are dirty. It is definitely not okay. But there is hope. As a child, I remember that when we had to go somewhere important or meet someone special, my mum would go through the same ritual. Did your mum do this? She'd sort of stand me in front of her, and if I was wearing a shirt and tie, she'd yank on the shirt and make sure it was all tucked in properly and straighten the tie. And then the bit that every boy dreads, I've probably been eating some chocolate or something, or eating some dirt in the back garden, something like that. And out comes the tissue from up her sleeve, dabs it on the tongue, and then starts wiping the muck off my face. And it left psychological scars, which are still very real to this day. If you have children, can I beg you, please? Actually, I caught myself doing this the other day, and it was one of the most, you know when you discover you've become your parents. Not good. Not good. But all she was trying to do, I guess, was to make me look presentable for someone else. Which is not such a bad way of thinking about what Jesus Christ was doing as he hung on the cross. There he was, he'd lived among. He knew that I have a conscience that is dirty before God, a heart that is filthy, that I'm totally unworthy of a place in heaven. And then by dying for me on the cross, by standing in for me, by taking the punishment that I deserve from God, the very hell that I deserve, Jesus is able to wash me clean, able to make me fit for the presence of God, to get rid of the defilement in my heart, and offer me a second chance with my glorious Maker, the chance to be one of his children again. You can ask me more about that in a minute if you want to. Can we be good without God? We can't even define what it is to be good. We certainly can't be good. But with God, not only does our society have the ethical framework and the moral boundaries that it so desperately needs, but if we come to him and ask him, then you and I can have the washing on the inside that we very desperately need. I've left time for questions, which is always a problem. I'll give you a 2-3 minute interval, scribble questions down, coffee will come to the tables, and then we'll finish questions by 10 to 2. Folks, we've now got 6 minutes, I think, and 16 questions, and the maths say that that's not going to work. That's more questions than I've ever had on a Thursday, so we'll do what we can, and you'll have to forgive me if I don't get through them. I'm around all afternoon if you want to come and chat some more, if you're able to do that. Do you mind if we leave women bishops for another day? Would that be okay? Do come and ask me about that afterwards if you want to. Can we present the following deductive argument to the atheist? Question from a Christian, I guess. If God does not exist, then objective moral values do not exist. 2, objective moral values do exist. 3, therefore logically it follows that God must exist. No, I don't think you can, because the very point at issue is whether or not there are objective moral values. And the atheist is wanting to argue, no, there is no such thing as an objective moral value. Now, everything that's kind of Western and post-Christian within us may rail at that and say, of course there are objective moral values. But how do you know? You can only know that there are objective moral values if there is an eternal God against whom we value all things and judge all things. And therefore, I don't think that that argument will hold up, I'm afraid. Then let me fob off 2 questions for the next 2 weeks, if I may. Is God good? We often don't see much evidence of it. If so, in what way? For example, there's lots of unfairness in the world. There's lots of suffering. That's the question. Is this the right order that I'm answering next week? So why does God let us suffer? That's next Thursday lunchtime. Do come back if you possibly can. And then second question to fob off, does the fact that people go to hell mean that God hates them? Are there limited seats in heaven? I'm speaking on the subject of hell in 2 weeks' time, so if you're able to come back for those, and if you can't get here, they'll be on our website, whatever it is. You'll be able to find details of it somewhere on the sheet, and you'll be able to download those and listen to them if you want to. So again, forgive me so that I can try and get on with some of these. This is a really good question. If we're not all good, what separates us from those who murder or rape, etc.? Are we afraid, scared, or guilt-stricken? In other words, how would God explain the difference, the relative goodness and badness of human behavior? When the Bible speaks of our nature, it speaks of us being bad to the core. But that doesn't mean that we're all as bad as we could be all of the time. It means that everything that we do in any circumstance will always be tainted in some way by wrong motivations, by pride, by a desire to look good in the eyes of others, a desire to make ourselves feel good about ourselves, that kind of thing. So I might help someone across the road, but I've never committed, I don't think, in all honesty, an entirely altruistic act. Always it's to make myself feel good or to look good in the eyes of others in some way. Why are we not worse than we are, given the nature of our hearts, as Jesus says here? Because in God's great kindness, he restrains evil in our world. And he prevents us from being as bad as we might be. But there is a lot of truth to the line that says, when I see someone in a particularly poor situation, there but for the grace of God go I. In all, I've never murdered anyone, and I've never had the opportunity to, and I've never had a particular desire to. But could I ever see myself in a situation where, in a different economic climate, without any money, without anywhere to turn, where I could find myself doing violence to someone else to get money? You're gonna leave, aren't you? In all honesty, yeah, I think there but for the grace of God go I. The only thing that stops me being worse than I am is not that I'm innately morally superior to someone else, but is God's kindness in restraining evil in our world. He does that on the international level, and he does it on the national level, and he does it on the individual level as well. Again, you can come back on me afterwards if you want that. There's a bunch of questions here, 5 or 6, which effectively say, but isn't the Christian bad as well? Doesn't the Christian keep on sinning? And therefore, isn't what Mark 7 says equally true of the Christian? It is certainly the case that Christians are not perfect, and nor do we claim to be perfect. But it is also the case that at the moment that someone first puts their trust in Jesus Christ, that a dramatic change happens to us. The Bible speaks of it in the language of new creation, sometimes of being born again, that sort of slightly freaky term, which says that we are given this whole new start before God, that our hearts are washed clean, that God writes his law on our hearts and gives us a desire to do good, which is why Christians can make moral progress in the world. It's true that we continue to fail, but such is God's kindness to us in coming to live within us and transform us and put his Holy Spirit within us, that there is no reason now why I need to fail in any particular instance of temptation. He's given me the resources that I need to be able to say no to lust or anger or deceit. The fact that I don't always avail myself of those shows more about the ongoing battle against the nature that there is within me. The Christian finds himself as something of a split personality. On the one hand, I long to do what is good, and yet there's a bit of me that doesn't, and that keeps choosing to do evil. And it will be that way with transformation and progress until the day that I die and go to be with God in his perfect new world, where he will have renewed my desires for good to such an extent that I will never choose evil again, not even once. And neither will anyone else who's there. And so the world will never again be spoiled by human selfishness. The question I want to finish with. Someone asked me to say more about hope, and someone said, if we're so rotten to the core, why would God send his son to die for us? Because he loves the world. It's an astonishing thing. Remember that famous verse? God so loved the world that he gave his only son, that whosoever believes in him should not perish, but have eternal life. When God sent Jesus to die on the cross and take his own anger upon himself, he wasn't doing it in some sort of gooey-eyed naivety, teenage naivety about the state of the world. He knew exactly what my heart was like. He knew the potential for evil in my heart. He knew every in his mind, every moment through my life, when I would live in defiance of his rule over me and when I would do something or say something or think something that demeans someone else. He knew every instance of it. He knew every instance of it for every one of his people in every generation through the history of the world, billions of them. He knew our hearts. There was nothing in us that should attract us to him. He didn't fall in love with us with our wicked hearts. He knew what we were like, and yet he chose to love us anyway. And so he sent Jesus to die on the cross. And he says, if you come to him, if you believe in him, if you trust in him, I'll wash your heart clean and I'll give you a place in a perfect new world. That is the wonder of the Christian faith. The baffling thing is that anyone would ever say no. Why don't I say a prayer and then you can go back to your desks if you don't want to hang around and chat some more. Let me pray. Our Father God, we thank you for revealing to us the true nature of our hearts. Please help us not to hide from that reality or think we know better than God on this matter. Show us, therefore, please, the extent of our sin in order that we might be blown away by the love that sent Jesus to the cross and by the offer of a clean heart. And we pray it for Jesus' sake. Amen. Thank you very much.